care, he's already my patient. But, you know, if someone, you know, the wife came and said, look, he seems lucid, he seems clear, he doesn't want to come to the hospital, he wants to die at home, you know, I would have to, I mean, what distinguishes ethically, right, if really we're assuming that, right, we need a justification, is it different because he's in a hospital already, he's already a patient? If he was home and the wife said he's not lucid, you know, he's not thinking clearly, does the doctor have the responsibility to go force him to have a transplant at home? No, because, right, there's something about, I mean, it seems there's something about him being in the hospital already, being a patient, that we can assume that there's a faulty reasoning. But
Well, it raises a lot of interesting questions. I mean, I think, you know, you're right. We don't, you know, we do. If it were my patient and I was, you know, there was someone was telling me that he was in an outpatient setting, I would certainly attempt to, you know, bring them into the hospital, bring them into the clinic, and try and figure out what's going on and what's happening here. I don't think that means I necessarily have to force the transplant on them.
But isn't that what's going
on
here? They're forcing a transplant on him because they are assuming that he's not thinking rationally.
Right. So, but part of what's going on also is the fact that this person is in the hospital. So when you think about a person's reasoning, you also have to put into place the whole context prior to this, right? This is someone who was seeking medical care. So it wasn't like a Christian Scientist who didn't believe in medical care at all and would never come to the hospital, right? So this was someone who was seeking medical care, presumably had other conversations with physicians about what the options were in terms of treatment, and heart transplant being one of them that they presumably embraced at one point, at some point in the past, or else they wouldn't have gotten to this point where they were listed for the heart transplant, right? So I think you're, I mean, it's an interesting question about how far you have to go with someone who's not in the hospital, but the very fact that this patient is in the hospital says something about what his prior preferences were.
So the question of being in the hospital is nothing fundamental about creating a relationship with the doctor that he now has to heal the patient. It's simply an assumption of what the patient himself means.
I think it tells us something about what this patient wanted in the past, and it gives us an opportunity to have more intense conversations about what their preferences are right now.
Yeah, it would seem to me that if you want to determine what the capacity of the patient is, in order to get to that point of whether he can make this decision, so I think that you cannot determine his capacity based on this particular case. I think that you would have to have a different set of criteria. You would have them take some sort of test, completely independent of the medical procedure that you're going to do. Because otherwise, if you're just determining it based on the decision that he makes, so you could always say, I, as a doctor, think that what he's saying doesn't make sense. And I disagree with his reasoning, and therefore he doesn't have the capacity to make the decision, and therefore I'll make the decision for him.
Okay, so first of all, the reality is, the practical reality, and this is what makes medical ethics so much fun, is that you actually have to make a decision, okay? You can't just say, I'm not going to make a decision now. You can't say, you know, I'm not going to assess his capacity right now. You have to. The heart is there, and you have to make a decision. Are you going to go to surgery or you're not going to go to surgery? Now, you have some leeway in terms of the time, but you don't have weeks, and you don't even have days. Okay, so you have to assess his capacity right now, and actually, I would suggest that it is critically important that you assess his capacity right now.
No, I understand that. What I'm saying is, don't use what his decision is as a test case. Use something completely unrelated as a test case.
Right. So, well,
by asking him some unrelated questions.
No.
Right now.
Actually, I don't think that that's the case. Okay. So, and I think this is important. There's a little bit of both of what you're saying. You're right. You don't assess it based on his decision, okay? And I think that that's really important. Our questioning his capacity ultimately is an outgrowth of the fact that this decision doesn't seem to make sense. But the fact that he is making a decision that we disagree with, it does not mean that he lacks capacity. It raises the question in our mind about whether or not he has capacity. But that in and of itself does not mean that the patient lacks capacity, okay? What it, The way in which we need to assess his capacity, however, is not just about asking him, okay, do you know what year it is, and do you know where you are right now, and do you know who the President of the United States is? And someone might be able to answer all of those questions. But that is, getting back to what Roy said earlier, is not a measure of a patient's reasoning abilities.
No, so ask questions that have to do with his reasoning ability, ask him math questions, ask him, you know, to analyze something, you know, but not related to the specific case.
Well, no, I disagree, actually. I think that what capacity is specific to a particular decision. And I will go further than that, when the risks involved in the decision, which in this case is, right, if he doesn't have the heart transplant, he has a risk of dying. When the risks are great, your threshold for...
the patient is doing makes sense. And then really, it's just paternalism. Again.
No, it's not. It's a doctor's decision to determine whether and to assess whether or not this patient has the capacity to make this decision. And again, that's why it's so critical to recognize that that should not be based on what the outcome of that decision is, but based on the patient's insight into the illness, their understanding of the question at hand, their ability to synthesize and reason about that information.
Well, I mean, what if the doctor understands that there could be no possible line of reasoning that makes sense that would lead to a certain decision? Wouldn't that automatically come out to the same result of saying that the decision is what determines whether or not the reasoning is reasonable?
That's certainly a possibility, but I think if the doctor probed deeper, in most circumstances, into the patient's reasoning... for refusing something, they would understand what underlies it. And if not...
Because, I mean, right, the line between disagreeing with a patient's reasoning and thinking that there's not capacity is a really gray and blurry line.
I don't think it is, actually. It's not as gray as it sounds. Right? If you're honest with yourself and you're putting aside the outcome and your assessment of capacity is focused on the patient's reasoning process, you're not focused on the decision, right?
I mean,
you're focused on how they got to that decision. So, for example, the Jehovah's Witness, Jehovah's Witnesses believe, for the most part, that they should not accept blood. That they take the pasuk in Vayikra that says that
you should go down one effort.
Right. And they interpret that very literally to mean that you cannot eat blood, and that by taking a blood transfusion, you are eating blood. Okay, so Jehovah's Witnesses will refuse blood transfusions even where it is life-sustaining. Okay, now a physician might say, "Well, that's crazy. You know, like how can you do that? How can, you know, it's such a simple thing for me to give you a blood transfusion. It's so easy for me to save your life. There's no risk involved at all in your getting this transfusion." How can you do that? It's completely irrational. I completely disagree with that decision. And that may be the case. And if you only focus on that, you would say this is crazy, and I should be paternalistic and just override that. But that's not the case, right? Once we understand that their refusal of blood fits into this religious context, into their, you know, you might disagree with their interpretation of the pasuk, but the fact that they can provide a narrative, that they can provide some reasons that a large group of people have bought into, that you may very well disagree with, allows you to say that this is, that they're reasoning about this in a way that is ethically legitimate.
But
so what I'm saying is that understanding that larger context helps you, so even in a situation where someone might be, you know, giving you something that making a decision that it sounds completely untenable.
It just seems there's going to be a lot of subjectivity in that. I mean, right? Let's say somebody says that they think that there's, you know, a bunch of demons that are going to come and eat them if you give them a blood transfusion. Now, you could say that that's, whatever, I don't know, psychosis or something, they're paranoid.
Right.
And then you could go out there and all of a sudden realize that there's a large group of people that believe that demons come and eat you if you get a blood transfusion, which in which case it becomes a religion.
You've been in this cult way too long.
Right, so you're raising a good question. At what point does a particular idiosyncratic belief become a religious, you know, become accepted as a religious belief that other people need to respect.
And if, I mean, if the doctor is religious, they're probably going to have a very different judge of that, than if the doctor is Richard Dawkins. Right?
So there's going to be, you're right, if you take it to that extreme, there's going to be some subjectivity, but those are, you know, that's not typically the situation that you're dealing with when you're assessing a patient's capacity. Rob?
So I think one of the it's certainly what I came into this with the assumption was that when we say that the patient has to make a rational decision, what we mean is that this narrative that you're describing that the patient has for justifying the decision has to be, from our perspective, I think we thought that it had to be a falsifiable narrative. And as a result, we could imagine situations in which there is not possible to create a falsifiable narrative in which one would lead to the decision that leads to a certain path. But what I think you're presenting us with it is the possibility of a non-falsifiable narrative. That if a patient has this non-falsifiable narrative, it's possible for them to have this in a case in which it would make it possible for there to be a case in which there would be an illogical.
It's okay.
Can someone finish my sentence there? Okay.
No, I mean, I know.
This is what happens when you say you're not speaking for everyone.
Okay.
Falsifiability.
Like I said, don't try to consent to life and death decisions.
Okay, so.
I think it's been like there's a couple of underlying. One question is there a default setting? Let's say that, like, so there are patients who can't give you narratives. All they can do is blink to give you yes or no's. And you can't get narratives out of them. All you can know is whether or not they consent or not. So do we?
So that gets back to this other question of whether or not someone can, if there can be a difference between what we except for their consenting versus their refusing. And so the default is that what we would consider most people to reasonably accept,
I think that's a really big point, that there are certain decisions which you have to prove capacity in order to have respected, and other decisions which are respected unless you can demonstrate incapacity. Is that a fair description? Like, but this is a case where if the patient had, right, if they hadn't been talking about life and death, other things, right? We would look at the patient and say, this is an obviously competent patient. But because they're making a decision that we have a bias to believing that most reasonable people would not make this decision, therefore we're telling this patient you have to prove your competence
exactly.
Rather than the other way around.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
I'll comment that who was your last name?
Applebaum
mentioned that one exception to informed consent's emergency,
yes.
When described, is that a reasonable patient would not want to ask questions in the case of death, which means that clearly when there is life, we do make a distinction when there is a life and death situation as to the mere, at least according to the sentence, that I'm wanting to ask questions in the case of life or death.
No, the aversion to exception only applies if the time taken to get the informed consent would materially affect the
emergency exception to informed consent is valid or legitimate if the patient would suffer severe harm as a result of engaging in the consent process.
Right.
In other words, if you the person needs to be intubated immediately, and if you don't put the breathing tube down their throat, then they're going to die. And if you start talking to them about whether or not they want the breathing tube put down their throat, they're going to die. So they're going to suffer severe harm. That's when the emergency exception to informed consent becomes.
It's relevant that we do have an assumed sort of idea of life as something,
I totally disagree with that statement, by the way, it's the way you said it. Because I just think practically speaking, in my experience with many patients who have terminal illnesses, it is not the case that patients who are facing death always want aggressive treatment. And even patients who may potentially get a heart transplant because, they've been through a tremendous amount. And getting a heart transplant is trading one disease for another disease, really. It's not like you get a heart transplant and you don't have to worry about anything. You're on immune suppressant medication for the rest of your life. It's there's a lot of risks associated with it. So it's not. I think it is quite reasonable for patients who have a terminal illness or who may be confronting death in the near future to actually raise questions and not, you know, not necessarily want them.
Yes.
My concern with regards to, you know, a case where the patient's decision, like in this one, is to refuse treatment, and then the physician makes an assessment that the patient is not able to make a decision,
does not have the capacity.
Right, he does not have the capacity to make a decision. Is that it is going against the nature of what informed consent is about, which is that we're trying to a certain extent restrict physician autonomy for the sake of patient autonomy. So then by even allowing the physician to make the evaluation about whether or not the patient is capable enough to make that decision, we're then bringing the physician back in where we've been trying to keep them out of it.
That's a really good point. And typically, the assessment of capacity is not usually made by that same physician. So, for example, in this case, it really wouldn't be the surgeon who would be assessing the patient's capacity. Okay? In many cases, I mean, there's no reason why the surgeon can't do it, but the only reason is that it takes time and you have to have a conversation with patients, and surgeons don't typically like to do that. So that's one reason. And I can say that having a father who's a surgeon, but who actually does take time and speak with his patients.
But even like medical professionals on the whole as a unit.
Right, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's a good point, but the reality is, on the other hand, the risk of not assessing patients' capacity has, there are significant downsides to that, right? Patients may actually, you may end up letting patients make decisions that are not in their best interest because they really didn't have the capacity to make them, and they're not necessarily what they would have made had they had the capacity. So if you can think of another alternative to that, it would be, you know, I think, interesting. Okay, so let's come back to informed consent. So we've talked a little bit about information in terms of disclosure of information that is necessary for that ethically valid informed consent. We've talked about capacity or you know, might be called competency, and how that's not focused on the decision but on the process, the reasoning process of the patient, their insight into their illness and the options available to them. And that, importantly, capacity is specific to a particular decision. It's not like you have capacity, okay? So capacity. The third thing that we haven't, depending on how you focus on it, is whether you consider disclosure to be part of the information or not. Let's do that. Let's say that the third aspect of an ethically valid informed consent is voluntariness. Okay? And so what do we mean by that? What does it mean for that we need voluntariness?
As opposed to coercion.
Good. Okay, and so what are some of the things that might coerce the patient?
Physical threats of something even more unpleasant than the negative outcome of consenting.
He was coerced by
trying to
speak
in broad terms.
Okay, good. So what we mean is that the decision has to be made freely, right? That there's the absence of coercion, and the coercion could be from some kind of physical threat, like the classic example of coercion is when someone has a gun to your head and telling you to do something or else I'll shoot you. But that's certainly not the only and not the common really situations of coercion.
Well, the way the information is presented.
Okay, good. So I don't know if I'd call that coercion, but I think that really is a component of voluntariness. In other words, is there really manipulation? Manipulation of the information. And that's how you're presenting that information. Are you presenting the information with the intention of having a particular decision being made, or a particular outcome from the patient? Are you manipulating the information, which is different than coercing them, where you're sort of saying that if you don't do this, I'm not going to do, you know, X, Y, or Z. So to go back, though, to the idea of voluntariness, and the fact that the decision has to be freely made, coercion can come from a variety of different factors, right? Family members can coerce patients too, right? Or put a tremendous amount of undue, what I call undue pressure on patients, to have a particular procedure because they want to see that this person continue to live. Right, so the family, the wife may you know feel like how can you do this to me? You can't die. I need you. You know, there can be a whole bunch of ways in which family members can put pressure on patients to have particular procedures. Yes.
Yeah, I just don't think it's reasonable to apply the coercion to anyone other than the physician, because any decision that a person makes is based on a number of different factors, personal factors, family factors, etc. So, you know, if the family is pressuring the person to stay alive, so then that's still voluntary. That's just another consideration that goes into the decision-making process.
Okay, it depends. I think you're right to a certain extent, but there are some family dynamics that are not as benign in the sense of just sort of offering your perspective and, you know, letting the patient take that into consideration. There are situations in which family members can put tremendous amount of pressure on patients to make decisions in which they don't feel free. They're not really voluntarily making a decision. They don't have the freedom to make that decision. So I think that in you're right. In most cases, people take into account a variety of perspectives, and people will give their perspective on it. But in some situations, family members put undue pressure, I would say, on patients.
Yeah. I mean, I was just had the same thing to be said.
Yeah.
I find it odd that you're categorizing manipulation in terms of being given certain bits of information that may bias a certain decision as a lack of
your goal, what the physician is trying to do. And when the physician is manipulating, they're twisting the facts in a certain way to achieve a particular outcome from the patient. Whereas in the persuasion, they're hoping that the patient is going to choose a certain outcome, but ultimately they're allowing the patient to come to their own decision, and they're just giving them information from their own perspective about why they should do that. Okay, I think you're absolutely right that this is part of the information side of things, but nevertheless, I think we have concerns. We would have concerns about the voluntary nature of the consent process if physicians were engaging in either, or patients were, if families were engaging in a process of coercion or manipulation. Okay, so the main point is that when you think about informed consent, you really need to be sure that these different elements have been considered, and that when the patients are making decisions, that they are actually doing it in a voluntary kind of way, in a voluntary situation. I'm sorry, I don't know who these hands were.
I have a question about somebody else. How is family coercion different from a rabbi paskening halacha? Like, kippur sucks, and you have to do this, where you know, the person on the one hand... On the one hand, it's somewhat voluntary that he's subordinate to that rabbi, but in reality, it's not really voluntary. In certain communities, you know, certain rabbis have very enough pressure, and he's obligated to follow that rabbi's talk. On the other hand, he didn't really have any voluntary...
I think it's a really great question, and I think it in part depends on your relationship to the whole concept of sock, and whether or not... In part, it has to do with the individual person's perception of how they have to accept or not accept. How are they, when they're asking that question, you're right, in many communities, in most communities, I would say the norm is probably that people are, you know, feel bound by that response. My own personal approach, you know, which is, you know, obviously idiosyncratic, is such that when I'm asking questions of rabbis, those questions are more information-seeking than, you know, in the category of tzak. Or where I'm going to feel, where there's any assumption, I think, either on the part of the rabbi that I'm asking the question of, or myself, that I'm going to be bound by their response. So I think you're asking an absolutely, you know, very important question, and I think it's important for, and I don't know what careers you guys are headed towards, but if some of you are headed towards the rabbinate, it is really important for you to be aware of the tremendous power that psak has, and to be aware of the coercive potential of it. In the same way that I think the physician, you know, can be very paternalistic And and there's a tremendous power in, and in some cases coerciveness of the physician's perspective on what the patient should do.
But a doctor's face in the patient in a Hasidic community where that Rebbe has basically absolute authority on anything that person does.
Right.
Is that Rebbe's opinion considered, is now anything he does considered as voluntary and, you know, not to be taken into consideration by the doctor? Or is that seen as the Rebbe's
basically? That also has to do with the Jehovah's Witness case we talked about, that a person can deny on the discussion if they accept that.
Right.
But
so
according to this, it doesn't seem like
I think
that.
Ultimately it's not, you know, so it's an interesting, it's a really interesting question, but ultimately in that kind of situation, I think that what the physician would conclude is that the decision making, the informed consent process was probably not ethically valid because it didn't really have the voluntariness, although you might say, the other element of it you could say is that, well, can a patient voluntarily decide, patients can voluntarily decide, I would say, to have someone else make decisions for them. And in many ways, what that, you know, the person who's accepting the psak of the rabbi is sort of saying, I don't want to make decisions for myself. I want you to make the decisions for me. Okay? And patients can do that. You know, and that's our, we can, you know, we have to accept that. So, okay, so the hour's late, and I apologize for, I don't know how long I had to go or when I was supposed to stop, but I wanted to just, first of all, you know, make sure that you understood what these different categories are, or what the different components of an ethically valid informed consent are, and then bring us back to this case in terms of whether or not you think that these criteria were met in this case, and this other question that we talked about whether or not someone can actually have the capacity to consent but not refuse. So thoughts about whether or not these components were actually achieved. Was the consent process from what you have written down here in this case actually ethically valid? What are you missing? What would you want to know? Or is everything okay?
Well, in the end, there certainly wasn't voluntariness. Now, that means they might be saying they're standing. I mean, that's, you know, what they're choosing to balance it on. But it's definitely not, number four is not in there at all. Or three, if we call it three on that list. Yeah. So. Because the patient just literally, you know, he was asked his opinion. He was, you know, it was, they listened to it, and then they went and did something else against his wishes.
Right.
So it wasn't voluntary. Now, there are many reasons you could think of why they might have done that, but they didn't fulfill
that. When we talk about voluntariness, we're talking about the actual decision, right? So you might say that actually the patient's
he did
decision
choose,
was voluntary.
But they didn't, yeah.
But the decision was not respected.
Okay.
And so why wasn't the patient's decision respected then?
Because they went against the reasonable person standard of they had no other reason to understand the decision except for suicide work.
Okay, so the reasonable person standard is a standard of disclosure.
No, I know,
okay?
But we also talked about with Rabbi Clapper what's the default setting?
Right.
That's
because he was giving
you
a decision that seemed to be unreasonable.
Exactly.
Okay. Presumably. I mean, but fundamentally, they were questioning his capacity. What we don't really know, there isn't enough detail in this case to know whether or not the questioning of the capacity was a result purely of the decision that he was making, okay, or of the fact that he really didn't have the capacity to make the decision once they probed deeper, okay, which is why my task here was to clarify for you what these different elements are, and especially to really try and get at and understand what we mean by capacity, because I think it's a difficult category, and it's not as cut and dry as you might think. Okay, so I think what was going on in this case is that there was really a questioning of this patient's capacity, and presumably once it was assessed that he did not have the capacity to make decisions, then they went to the wife and asked her, because, as you said at the very outset, the wife was presumably the healthcare proxy or that had the durable power of attorney, so the person that we would turn to next in order to make decisions. Okay? So what about the third question on the sheet? Can someone have the capacity to consent to treatment but not refuse treatment? How should we understand that after we've talked about this now?
Going back to but I have this question about default setting. I don't know if you can say someone can have the capacity to consent to a treatment confusing, but you can say that the need to justify capacity for achievement can be determined by consent versus refusal. That if I consent to... The need to justify your decision and show your capacity can be different based on consenting versus refusing achievement.
Okay, does that make sense to people?
Another rephrasing it is that you're reasonable until evidence shows that you're unreasonable.
Right. And that may be your initial inclination, but until you probe deeper and really figure out whether the person is unreasonable,
right.
You
certainly. But
we
only start checking once we think you might be unreasonable.
Right.
So sort of like innocent until proven guilty. We don't start checking everybody in the street.
Right.
Until something comes up.
Okay.
I can't accept that decision. I think your default setting has to be completely proven otherwise, regardless of the decision.
Well, then how else, when would you question a person's capacity then? If you're always competent, what makes you wonder whether or not this person has the capacity to make decisions?
They have to be frothing at the mouth, is that what you're saying? Comatose?
I mean, if I'm talking to them and I see they're, completely demented, that's one thing, but I don't think I could ever use a decision on this particular on this particular treatment as a basis for questioning competence.
Is it mentioning competence or for determining?
As a basis for saying incompetent until proven otherwise.
Well, it's somewhat of a linguistic game. Whether you say that, you don't have to necessarily say that they're incompetent to prove it otherwise. You're saying we're questioning his capacity. We don't know. We don't know if this person is telling us something that doesn't make sense.
It's giving us an
indication to ask more questions. It's what we call in medicine a red flag.
Who has the burden of proof is a big deal, though.
Right. So who has the burden of proof?
I think the doctor always, 100% of the time, has the burden of proof to show incompetence.
Yes, but the only way in which the doctor can show incompetence is by questioning that competence to begin with.
So you think
right?
Question everybody's having? Everybody should pass a reasonable test before they enter the hospital?
I could deal with that.
Yeah, it's just time-consuming and not... We didn't even talk about some of the... I hope we talked a little bit about some of the obstacles to informed consent. And, are there situations in which maybe you'd say you don't even need informed consent or you shouldn't get informed consent? But part of the reason why one of the major obstacles to informed consent and one of the major obstacles to actually really thinking about informed consent as a process as opposed to just a form that someone signs, which is what happens in many, many situations, is time, right? Doctors don't have a lot of time, and they're not interested in engaging in that kind of level of conversation with patients, right? Just practically speaking. Hopefully, it's happening where...
So hospitals require more emphasis on their staff.
I'm happy to accept that.
If you pay the health insurance costs.
But I think part of the discomfort when someone presented, or maybe I'm projecting on the effect also, is that I think the distinction is that the refusal of the treatment shouldn't be one... It could be a red flag that might then lead to other questions, but that can't count as part of the test of confidence.
But I said I hope I'm clear that is absolutely the case.
Right.
You are absolutely right. That decision is not a measure of the person's capacity or competency. Okay? It's an indication for us to probe further and assess their capacity.
But if you find nothing else, you find nothing else.
Right, well, exactly. If you find nothing else, that person has the right to refuse. But
yeah.
If the act of refusal otherwise, it can be refused. You take away all the autonomy.
Right.
You don't give them that right. So you can question it, but that can't be then one of the question tests.
It's not. Absolutely.
I think this comes up in an emergency context. But let's say an emergency situation in which the case that happened within our family, I think at some point in the recent past, where we brought our 4-year-old into treatment, and they threw a informed consent form at us while telling us there was a risk given by the treatment needed.
Right.
So now let's suppose we say no. Right. Well, let's suppose in the case you're a patient here, that the patient that you've budgeted the time for informed consent before you have to go to surgery, and guess what? At the end of the time you've explained informed consent, the patient says no, and that raises a red flag for you. You have no time left. So right at that point, right, that's I think where Rory and David's case becomes critical, because it's nice to say that in that case we have a red flag. you have a red flag now. You can't. You don't have time to prove one way or the other. Does it shift the default to saying that since this the patient made a decision that it's prima facie irrational, even though we have no other evidence of irrationality, would we ignore them? Or do we say that, no, patients are always competent until proven otherwise, and so we have to accept their lack of consent?
So, I think you may get different answers to that question depending on who you ask. But my own opinion, and I think probably the more common response, would be that you absolutely treat. Because you can always, you're more conservative, you can always withdraw that treatment. Right, even though halakhically that may create more problems. Well, some people would say by withdrawing the treatment you are killing them, and actually
you're assuming it's an ongoing treatment.
But
what if it's a one-time treatment? Then they just want to die.
Oh yeah, yeah. So that actually has come up a lot. You're right. So then you're sort of taking away their opportunity,
yeah.
Right, to die. And you're right. That's a problem. We've actually had some interesting cases like that, and patients who were really angry after the fact. You don't let them die.
And if his wife wants him to die too.
Pardon me?
And if his wife wants him to die too. So we'll go to the next.
You're saying, what would happen in this case if the wife said, well, then she would probably, they would say, oh, if she agrees with whatever his reasoning was, then it must not be unreasonable
in
the first place.
If his wife said, in this case, I don't want you to go ahead with the transplant, he really doesn't want it, and this is why, and he's just not articulating it clearly, or he's not making sense, but we've talked about this, and he's decided that he doesn't really want it, then they wouldn't do it. It'd be unlikely for it to happen. Okay, I think in most settings. But to respond to your question, just to be clear, most people would intervene, would act, would provide treatment in an emergency situation if there wasn't clarity, and on the assumption that it can be withdrawn. Obviously, there's some risks to that if it's a one-time treatment that is not an issue of withdrawing it in terms of a window of opportunity for a patient to die. Is to do is to really understand the whole context there, and it takes work, right? If you're not from, you're not necessarily going to get it right away, okay? But if you begin to ask a series of questions, you'll understand that this is a belief that fits into a larger system, and that it makes sense within their own thought processes and their whole belief system. Okay,
but
so
reality question: how often in the real world, that people spend lots and lots of time trying to explain patients' narratives when patients give a response that they think the patient wrong?
I think that when that happens, there's a lot of time spent on it, actually.
Well,
I think we mean by a lot of time, okay? But you know, I can tell you from my own experience, there can be, I've been involved in cases where we've had, 45-minute, hour-long conversations with patients, and repeatedly to try and assess what's going on, okay? So is that a lot of time? I mean, in the medical context, that's a lot of time. And there's a desire to ensure that the decisions are sustainable. You know, that it's not they're not decisions being made on a whim. That there's some consistency in the and in the thought processes, and that they're repeated. You know, that we have some sense that they're really legitimate. So, but that's in the rare circumstance. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that that's in a relatively rare circumstance where the patient is requesting something that seems so at odds with what most people would want. Yes.
The whole notion of most people. There's a book, Sanity and Sanctity, which tries to understand these by psychologists who work in Jerusalem. In the Haredi community, pointing out just as a case study how many years it takes to be able to understand what would be considered, an aberration from the norm in a given community, because it just took several examples that just to even have the slightest notion of what it means to something be an aberration for a person within their own social context, 45 minutes. It's a long time. That's not a long time. They gave an example, the simplest of example. If you have someone who's committed to halacha and you just write down what he does in the first 10 minutes of his day, down from the, most careful details of washing his hands in a certain order and, what order he ties his shoes, right, and everything in between, right, and you compare that to someone with obsessive compulsive disorder, right, you need to understand the entire psychology of the Orthodox community before you realize that person is not obsessive compulsive. And to say that a doctor can assume that a decision is prima facie irrational to the point that they need to prove that that is rational simply because that doctor on a whim can say it's what most people would do assumes a tremendous amount about the doctor's ability to understand social context that is I'm just not sure is fair to assume unless you're assuming the doctor has a certain amount, unless you're limiting the ability of of patient autonomy because it.
Right. So I think it's important to recognize that the whole idea of assessing patients' capacity is not intended to limit patient autonomy, but it's actually an outgrowth of our desire to respect patient autonomy, because the assumption is that patients that don't have the capacity to make decisions are actually not making decisions. When they lack capacity, they're not making decisions that are really consistent with what we would say would be their true preferences or their true autonomy. Okay, so it's important to recognize that this whole idea of assessing capacity is really is meant to try and uphold this concept of autonomy, right? It's incorporated into this informed consent process as one of the factors that we need to we're trying to make sure the patients have understanding. The goal is to ensure that they have understanding. But your question about whether are we making too many assumptions here is a really good one. And it probably depends on the nature of the society that you're living in and what kind of how familiar you are with the patient population that you're taking care of, and over time doctors probably become more aware and have better understanding of that variability in cultural context. And, right? I think that's the best that you can ask that people do. I'm not. I think there is an attempt to encourage cultural sensitivity on the part of the physicians so that they can have a better understanding of different religious beliefs and the different positions that are attached to those groups.
This might be a little off topic, and so you don't have to answer it, but I'm actually really curious about what the process by which all of these concepts capacity or voluntariness sort of get onto the books. Are they part of the law that's initially passed, or are they, do they come up as sort of like judges invent them in court cases or lawyers, or how do they spring into being?
It's a complicated question, and I'm not sure I really know the answer, or I'm not sure that there is one clear answer to that. I would think that it's an evolutionary process in many ways, and we learn from different cases and examples, and some of it is through cases going to the courts and some of these concepts becoming elaborated more clearly, and people write, you know, the dialogue that occurs in the scholarly literature on these topics, it's sort of a pretty complex process of developing ideas, you know, that advances our understanding and hopefully advances our improves the ultimately the goal is to improve the quality of the medical care we provide to patients. Okay, so I think we'll stop there. Thank you very much. People have other questions, you can feel free to email me. I put my email on the pieces.
Thank you.